Welcome your backup plan tribe to this week's podcast. It's going to be an amazing one, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one. My name is Tina Ginn. Welcome aboard Talking Taboo with Tina. I am an emergency preparedness coach, a best-selling author of In the Blink of an Eye. It happens that quick, in the blink of an eye. Sometimes crap happens. Sometimes shit hits the fan, as that old saying goes. And, you know, you wonder, why wasn't I prepared? Exactly. I'm a financial expert and an app developer of Your Backup Plan app. I'm located right here in Vancouver, BC, in Canada. If you are new here, welcome aboard. Welcome to our show brought to you by Your Backup Plan app. We focus on real, raw conversations with our listeners about their journey from a life-changing event in their life. What is your backup plan app anyways, Tina? Don't they say that? What the heck is it? It puts your life all in one place. So in case of any unpredictable circumstance, well, taking that painful aftermath out of that tragedy. And I'm going to use a quick example. So in the invasion of Ukraine right now, as we speak, currently in 2022, which is totally absurd to even think about, we had quite a few thousand Ukrainians going to Russia in buses to camps. They took their documents away. They took their passports, any documentation of who they are and their life. They took away their phones, which is our life. It's who we are. It's how we get to contact all those other people in our lives. So what would have happened if they had this done to them is that, who are they? And I want to take a quick second, because if you had a backup plan, you had had everything in the cloud, and it wouldn't matter if you still had your phone. It wouldn't matter if you don't actually have your personal paper documents, because you have a backup plan. You have everything set in one place, protected, so that when you log in again somewhere at some time, you can get your stuff back. You can find out, you know, you're protected, that it's okay. You have somebody else that can reach your documents if needed. You have you that can reach your documents if needed. So that's just my Tina's analogy for today, in our show today, because it's terrible what's going on in the world right now. Just terrible. So be prepared for the unexpected. It won't happen to me, but it will. Things happen. You say before a car accident, hold on, don't hit me, I'm not prepared. That doesn't happen. Mike Tyson's famous quote is, everyone has a plan till you get punched in the mouth. It's true. So getting this show started, you won't believe we have a very special guest, Jack Gregory, who is coming to you from the UK today. Criminal to homeless to addict to Hollywood and author. Wow. He has had so much in his life happen to him that it's going to blow you away in the story today. So, we are getting ready to launch our Blueprint program, which is a variety of videos, interviews, podcasts, templates, worksheets for you to download and print to have those real raw family conversations with those that you love around you. There'll be resource guides and a full building a treasure chest in case of anything. How would you like to leave that legacy for those that are left behind? All of that stuff is all going to be found in the Emerging Blueprint, which is launching very, very soon. I'd like to welcome all of our new guests and also those that are returning. So I'm very, very thankful. If you haven't hit that subscribe button, please do. Down here in the corner, I get my hand out, press on that subscribe button and click on the bell so that you can get notified of any upcoming videos and you won't miss one. If you have found us today, you are here for a reason. I'd like to welcome all of our guests, United States, Canada, all our listeners, UK, Ireland, Germany, and many other countries that are now kicking some butt, getting up those to the top five listeners. Germany has been there for a while. I think their place is third spot. So I'd like to welcome my German listeners. Meine deutsche Freunde sind unserem Podcast willkommen. Wenn Sie Kommentare haben, können Sie gern Fragen stellen. Also danke für deine Freundschaft. Danke fürs Hören, meine deutsche Freunde. So thank you very much. If you have found us today, thank you for coming and listening and spending your valuable time with us today. So let's get this party started with our special guest, Jack Gregory, coming to you from the UK. Hi, Jack.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Awesome, awesome. No problem at all. Jack Gregory is coming to us from near London, UK. He is a journalist, author, and a podcaster. And his description of all of his stuff is down below in the description box. So welcome, Jack. I'm so pleased to have you come on board our podcast today. And where did this, I don't even know what to call it for you, Jack, because it's just been a journey for you, definitely.
Yeah, it's been a battle. It's been a journey. It's been a long road, but one that's been travelled for many years. But I'm finally sort of coming to my destination, really, of being a better man.
Absolutely. I see you're giving back a lot, and you're healing in the process, and it's all great.
Yeah, to give back is a blessing. It's a blessing on me and a blessing on other people. It's, I believe, once we've lived a certain way of life, once we've been through certain things like trauma, addiction, mental illness, anything like that, I think it's important to be able to educate, as well as listen and give a voice to those that may need one.
Yes.
Yeah.
So where did it start? What would you go back to, do you think, to tell your story?
Right. Okay, so 8 years old, the weekend of my eighth birthday, must be 1985. I'd had a really nice day. Lots of presents. I grew up in a small mining town in the county of Yorkshire, in the north of England. And this is a mining town that was surrounded by mining towns. So pretty much every town that surrounds, it's called Five Towns. So the other towns that surround were all mining towns, and all market towns as well. But in 1984, our Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, in her infinite wisdom, decided that it would be cheaper to buy coal from France, cheaper to buy coal from any other country but our own country. So the North, being industrial and mining, it suffered. The unions got involved. There were strikes, there was riots. And that was pretty much on my doorstep. And a lot of the towns have never sort of recovered from that. Not really. They have started now. They're bringing more sort of entertainment industry into the towns around. But so, yeah. But I grew up in quite an affluent family. My dad was a civil engineer for British Rail, so he worked on the trains. And my mum was a social worker. She worked with social services. And, you know, I had a sister and everything was great. I was a bit quiet. I was a bit weird. But, you know, the other kids in the neighbourhood thought I was a bit weird. But
why do you think they felt you were weird?
I was
quiet.
I was very quiet. I wasn't very strong. I was quite feeble and weak compared to some of the other kids. I was very small and frail. So I remember on my 8th birthday weekend, and you know, I'd had pop and you call it soda and crisps and cakes on this. We have these platters where we have like, tiered platters where we have like cakes and scones and just, you know, lots of treats. So it was great. And then, you know, later on in the day, we were sat watching the television and my dad would be reading his newspaper, looking over his glasses. And I was sat, I remember quite vividly, I was sat on my mum's knee. And in retrospect, I can now see the pain that she must have held in her heart and in her eyes. But she said, you know, we love you very much. But you weren't ours.
There's a big but coming.
Yeah, you weren't ours. You are now. You're now legally adopted. You've got a real mum somewhere. But she couldn't take care of you. So that, for many people, I think, maybe that would be, we love you. That's a validation of love. You know, you were taken from a situation. But for me, with my divergent brain, all I got was, I'm not loved by someone. How could I be loved enough, not enough to be given away? I wasn't given away. You know, it wasn't through choice.
But in your head.
But in my head. And that was the first trauma for me, the first trauma that's when the lights went out. That's how I describe it. It's when the lights went out and things went dark for all so many years. So I'm 8 years old and I'm having an existential crisis. It's hard at any age, you know, even at 45 like I am now, you know, it would be hard. But at 8 years old, having an existential crisis, you don't know what to do. I was seen as low intelligence in a time when there was no real such thing as dyslexia, or, you know, it was known about, but there wasn't very much help for it. You know, you were either in the mainstream schools or not. I stayed in the mainstream schools for a while. So how I dealt with it was, I lied. I created a world in my head. Because I thought, well, I'm not the person that I thought I was. You know, this is not the family that I thought it was. I felt betrayed and lied to. So I created this, I can be anybody I want. If I don't know who I am, I can be anybody I want. I was good with the stories in my head. I've always been good with words and general knowledge. I just couldn't get them down onto paper. So I began to lie, and I began to tell these almighty lies. You know, that nobody would ever believe, but you know, they just saw me as a kid crying for help, really, or just being a bit annoying. They used to call me Billy Liar.
Oh, really?
Because that's a book here, but and a play. But you know, my Christian name actually is William. And so yeah, they call me Billy Liar. But I tried to get on, and I just couldn't get on with any of the other kids. They thought I was strange. They thought I was weird. This added to being very weak and lying, and that I went on in the middle school, and then the first year of high school, and they decided that I couldn't handle the mainstream, so they put me into the special school system. Now the special school system here it was basically a school for maladjusted children masked as a special school.
With special learning disabilities?
Yeah, learning disabilities. You know. And it was in a town that was really affected by the mining crisis. A lot of the kids in the school were from mining families, so they were from the poorer families. Some of that, I think you might call them welfare estates, but we call them council estates. And, you know, broken families, and I didn't understand any of this.
Yeah.
But they settled things with violence. So I got to this school, and, you know, there's no exams, there's no real process of once you leave school that, you know, any sort of qualifications.
Yeah, they rewarded bad behavior.
Yeah, exactly. So they reward bad behavior with really good things. So if you were bad, they sent you off with the army youth team. They would take you abseiling, climbing, caving, canoeing. You know, so by the time I left school, I could barely read or write my name, but I could pretty much teach climbing, caving, canoeing, abseiling.
That's crazy.
I had a certificate. I've got a certificate for riding a 50cc moped. I've got a certificate for answering a private telephone. And that's about it. There was no real chance. There were college courses that you could go on, but there was no real chance. Mm-hmm. So I'm in this school, and I'm out my depth, getting bullied really, really badly. The teachers saw this. And because it's a special school, you've got social workers as well. And that's when the sexual abuse started. So I'm about 11, 12 years old, and I'm being abused by some of the adults in charge sexually. And they would keep me intact by saying, well, everybody knows you're a liar.
Oh.
Nobody's ever going to believe you. And I believed this for many, many years. And I carried this for many, many years. So I became good at covering my feelings with more lies. But I also became really good at running. I was on the school cross-country team. The school was a mile from anywhere, so on the dinner time I would run, knock off cigarettes, cannabis, VHS, pirated VHS, pirated CDs had just started to come out. I remember it was really hard to do, but I remember the Prodigy Fat of the Land was one of the first ones that I got. So when I left school, I left school with quite a bit of money. I left school with a good work ethic. I was doing a paper round on a morning. I was waking up on a morning. I was doing a milk round about 2-3 a.m. Getting back home, having another breakfast and a little bit of a sleep, and then I'd be out for a paper round, and then I'd be at school, and then another paper round after school, and then on a Saturday I had a paper round in the morning, first thing in the morning, and then I went to work in a key cutting shop until 1 p.m. and then from 2 to 5 p.m. I worked in a plaster shop making dado rails.
I had money. Workaholic.
I was. You know, most of this was when I was still at school. But I was drinking. I was taking whatever drugs I could. My
what
teachers
did you
and the
take?
Weed, magic mushrooms once at school. That's not a good idea. mainly weed and drink, and maybe a bit of coke.
Do you think it felt it relieved some of that stuff in your head?
I didn't have to. I could think of other things, and I could concentrate on other things. So, and the teachers saw this, you know, and there were a few good teachers, you know, that
cared.
You know, they cared, and you know, they would sit with you and have a cigarette at dinner time or break time or whatever, or when you were out caving and stuff. And just, you know, I think they knew what was going on, but they, you know, they couldn't really do anything about it. Well, they could, but, you know, they were doing the best just to make sure that
they chose not to.
Yeah, either through fear or whatever. But 14 years old, I was sent to my first AA meeting.
Wow.
And I was met there by one of the social workers' friends. So needless to say, I was being passed around. I was being trafficked by these people. Some men, some women, mostly men.
Ugh.
So I went into my own world and I created these stories, and I began to mimic people, and I began to do accents, and I began to act, and I was going to a college on a Saturday where I was doing the National Youth Theatre, you know, and getting some acting lessons. And then when I was old enough to leave school, I ran out of school on the last day. And I pretty much left home at 16, 17.
Did you know what you were going to?
No, I didn't. I was still quite naive, I think. You know, I'm a kid that was brought up in a town where everybody knew my parents. Going to the local church on a Sunday, and so I rebelled and tried Islam, and I tried Buddhism, and I tried Jediism, whatever, you know, anything that I could to sort of rebel and find some sort of spiritual anchor. But I never really found it at that time. So I moved into a flat in this town where I went to school, it was a bedsit. So it's basically one room. I suppose you'd call it a studio apartment, but it's like one room. And you've got bed in there, and you've got a settee in there, and a telly and whatever, yeah. And then a kitchen and a bathroom, and that's it. It's not much bigger than a prison cell, to be honest. Not much bigger than the shed I'm sitting in now. But it was home. I fell into the lie. I did. I felt safe, but I fell into the lie that I needed AA and NA. I needed the program. I didn't need the meetings. But, you know, I was drinking. I was using drugs. I was partying. And it started to get darker. I had a guy called Carl, my best friend at the time. He was gay and he was living on my sofa. Didn't really know how to tell his parents.
Another situation.
Yeah. And you know, we went on an almighty bender. So from the Thursday, we took about, over the weekend, about 8 ecstasy.
Oh.
Cocaine, MDMA, alcohol, weed. We went to his brother's out in Bradford. We'd got quite a bit of money and by hook or by crook, and we went out and we just did a good weekend, good long weekend. And on the way home, we're walking. And we're coming up to a railway track. And I lit a cigarette. Took a drag and gave it to him, and he took a drag and gave me it back. And we was just there talking, and the, you know, you hear the noise, and the arm of the gate begins to go down. And you could hear the rumble of the train in the background. And
I have a feeling I know what's coming.
He looked at me in my eyes and said, "You know what? I love you, mate."
Oh, no.
I said, "I love you too, you old puff. No, you know, give me my cig back."
Not thinking anything.
Not thinking anything. And he smiled, put his hand on my face and bolted. Vaulted the arm and was hit by the train. And I couldn't do anything. All I could do was scream and beat my hands on the floor as people held me back.
Ugh.
And it got hard. It got hard for a long time. It's something I never really got over. I had a friend called Darren. He lived above me. He was 33 years old. He became a mentor. He was the first person to kidnap me out of my flat and put me into his spare room and lock the door and make me go through cold turkey and sit there and love me while I screamed at him and obscenities and tried to hit him. He was 6'5" and built like a shed. You know, I'm 6'2", but he was 6'5" and about 20 stone. He was big bear of a man with long hair. You know, he was a bit of a rocker. And I loved him to bits. He was great. He taught me how to DJ. He taught me how to do close-up magic. Tried to get me away from some of the emotional vampires that were hanging about, and, you know, the ones that were using me for my money, you know, for the money and for the drugs and stuff. He tried to get me away from it. And then he was killed in an accident in 1999. So I lost him. And I never did know how to deal with grief.
Of course not.
And I ended up moving away to the opposite end of the country to get away from it. But I ended up in prison. Now, I don't talk about prison a lot. What I will say is I'm not the sort of person that can be locked away, because I'm a very free spirit.
How old were you then?
And I'd lost my temper. I saw a man hitting a woman and I lost my temper. And the first time in my life, I flung out, and I found out that actually I can take a bloody good kick in, and I can hit harder than most other people.
That's surprising what your brain can do.
So I put him in ICU.
Oh dear.
For 11 days. I hated every day of prison, and I ran from that gate when I got out. And unlike a lot of the other podcasters here, you know, a lot of them that I've got respect for, and, you know, a lot of them fit in with the remit of true crime that are, you know, they talk about, you know, with fondness sometimes, too much fondness about their life, you know, their life in prison and the people that they serve with. And a lot of them were all in prison together, and that's great. I didn't have that. I hated every minute of it, and I felt suffocated every minute of it. So when I got out, I ran as far as I could. So I ended up in a place called Portsmouth at the other end of the country, 2000. And
so you were in there for a year, were you, Jack?
Yeah, just over. Yeah. And I'd start to get sober. I went to a rehab. I was doing day programs and things were going good. You know, I was on this thing called the Cranston Project, which was like a cafe, and you would go during the day, and, you know, you would have chats in this cafe atmosphere, in the days when you could smoke indoors. You know, so they'd let you smoke your cigarettes and drink your coffee and your tea. And, you know, they focused on holistic things like acupuncture and massage and stuff like that to kind of try and get your body better. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I went to, I had a guy that said, as you can see, I love films, and I've always had a thing for films. And he said, well, if you can get to 30 days, I'll take you to a film set. So I did, and he did. He kept up with his promise. It was a pretty, I can't really say which one it was, but, you know, it was a big British film back then. And I fell in love with it. You know, I fell in love with the lifestyle. I joined what's called the Prince's Trust and the Duke of Edinburgh. So by the time I'd finished that, I was 6 months sober. I graduated. I was working in an entertainment venue as a comedy club magician, and I was a sound technician. So I'd learnt the trade. You know, and I got to do some of the sound for some of the couple of American bands that one of them was called Four Star Mary, and they were the actual band that did, don't know if you remember Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah.
The band in that, Dingoes Ate My Baby, the actual songs were by Four Star Mary. And so I got to do it for them, and it was great. It was great. And I met a woman, and she lived in Norfolk on 2001. I moved, built a family. She had, you know, she had a few kids, and I was doing good. I became a, I'd, you know, I stopped drinking, stopped using. I became a community director. I was trusted within the community. I was going on courses. I got to meet some fantastic people. I got to sing for George Michael.
Cool.
You know.
Poor old and George then, Michael.
Yeah, he was a really nice guy. And
yeah. I've heard that.
That was around about 2005. My daughter was born. We got married in 2006. My daughter was born in 2007. Things were great. 2009, I decided that I wanted to write my life story as a film, but I wanted to make it into, mask it as fiction. So I wrote the screenplay. It was going great. I had some big names in the British film industry that wanted to make it. Started drinking again socially. Started doing lines again. And I started declining and declining and declining. And I fooled myself that I could
do both. You could. You felt you could do both.
And I managed it for a couple of years. 2012, my marriage ended. It had been ending for a while. I wasn't a good man. You know, I was doing a lot of drugs and drinking a lot and cheating on my wife. Not proud of it.
Because that's the life.
And then, like I said, my marriage ended and I ended up in and out of different places. And, you know, I would spend my rent money on drugs and I would get kicked out and then I'd find somewhere else and get caught in this vicious cycle. And I ended up homeless, addicted. We started making this film with some of the local, we've got a big university here that was, one of the patrons was John Hurt. He lived a couple of towns away, but he was one of the patrons of the film university. And you know, I met a few people and we decided to make it. So I was doing a bit of acting and a bit of producing and stuff like that, and I got ill, I got lymphoma. And on the day that we were doing some filming for a promo, I had chemo, then went and got drunk, and then turned up on set after having a couple of lines of coke. I'd been seeing about three or four different women at the time as well, because it was somewhere to sleep. And I'm not proud of how I treated women. Not at all. I know the reasons why I treated women like that, because some of it was to do with how I viewed my, how I viewed how people were treated in the past with sexual relationships. And abuse. And, you know, I didn't abuse them, but I was addicted to sex. Now, you know, I was addicted to relationships. Turned up on set, and this one producer, he said, oh, we've just got a, could see my eyes and stuff, and he said, we've just got a form for you to fill in. We need you to just, you know, it's an actor's release form so we can do it all legally. And he tricked me into signing the film away for 4 years. And I lost it. Uh-huh. I lost everything. I ended up on the street. Very, very angry. There was places where I was able to stay sometimes, but I was spending two or three nights a week in the shop doorway of HMV in Norwich. This was 2014. I've been going to a food bank on a Friday morning. It was like a coffee shop. They had like a little coffee shop in there, and you know, you could go in there and you could get something to eat, and you know, they'd give you a bit of food to take away with you. Kind of been staying in someone's spare room. He was as bad as me for the weed, so you know, we
wasn't a good combination.
It wasn't a good combination at all. You know, we were out stealing on a night, and you know, I'd done some fighting for money in the past, but I didn't want to go back down that road. I was quite weak anyway. By that time, my body had started to sort of fail. And then 8 years ago, Monday, I was in there.
You met the love of your life.
I was in there, and she'd missed the bus. She'd had a panic attack. She, you know, but she got there, and she served me with a smile, and she said, I had a Doctor Who t-shirt on. She said, I love Doctor Who. I love your t-shirt. And we got talking, and she offered to take me for a meal, something to eat. And she brought me tobacco. You know, there were people there, you know, it's in a church, and they were like, no, you shouldn't really do that. And she's like, no, I'll do it. And she did. And, you know, we made that connection, and it was really nice. I had a number. I had to go home back to Yorkshire for a little while because my auntie had died and then my uncle had died in a short space of time. And then I'd started talking to her on the train on the way back from the funeral. And I came to see her, and we started this relationship. I was still using. I was lying about it. I was by far from a good man. Having a relationship with several other people, but she knows about this. We weren't really together until the September, October time as a couple. I moved exclusive. In September, October.
Having an exclusive. Yeah.
Yeah, I moved in the September, October. And, yeah, I was... now, before that, I must say, before that, I'd met this woman and I thought she was great. And I couldn't live like I'd been living. I didn't want to do it anymore. I had a massive... mental breakdown. My now ex-wife told me that she didn't want me to see my daughter when I was in any sort of state, but what I heard was, I don't want you to see your daughter. Hence me trying to punch my way through a solid oak door, scaring the kids in the process. I went to a crack house. 26th of June 2014. 10 o'clock at night, sat in a crack house with a bowl of crack. And I said, I can't do this anymore. God, kill me. Just take me. Please, God, just take me. And if you won't take me, take away this hunger for drugs. Take away this thirst for crack cocaine. And I fell asleep. Woke up at 1 minute past 12, 27th of June, 2014, and I haven't used a day since.
That's amazing.
He took that away from me. Now, a lot of people will go, yes, you know, God exists. And I went, yes, God exists. I can go in these things. So, you know, I wasn't using drugs, but I, you know, I drink, but it was going through the motions. I was going to a church on a Sunday and it was nice, but I was losing weight. Then I'd started to get quite ill. Started coughing up blood. And I felt really ill. I picked my daughter up on the Friday from her mum's to bring her to where I now live in Wyndham, and picked her up from school and managed to do that. And then we took her back to her mum's and she got a bag, and then we got 100 yards down the road and every single bit of air just exhaled from my body. And I went, and I couldn't breathe. And I just sat, trying not to scare my daughter. Managed to get it back, get my breath back. But got home and I started shaking so hard that night I nearly left the bed. I was literally like that. I was taking paracetamol, ibuprofen, anything that I could just to try and calm the tremors down. I'd been in the February, I'd been in the hospital with a stomach problem. And I'd been quite ill with that. And on the 7 years ago, yesterday, I woke up in the morning and I thought, I can't do this. It's a Sunday. I thought, I can't do this. I need to go to the hospital. I rang my ex-wife and said, look, I need you to come and get our daughter, please, because I need to go to the hospital. I need to get an ambulance. She said, don't get an ambulance. I'll come and get you both. We'll take you to the hospital. You can give your daughter a kiss and a cuddle before you go in to show her that it's going to be all right. And that's what I did. 4:30, they saw me. By 7:30, I was dead. 6 stone, 6 ounces. It's about 82 pounds. 82 pounds.
Yeah. You're just bones.
I was just bones. Lost 50% of my muscle mass. Type 2 lung failure, tuberculosis, pleurisy, some disease that they hadn't, environmental disease, a bit like TB, but they hadn't seen it in 50 years. My mind broke, full of guilt and shame and fear, battling mental health my whole life. The things that they gave me, the medication, was like bleaching a needle. It was sent my mind awry. And I became convinced that God was ending the world because I'd spread this super virulent strain of tuberculosis that was killing people within a day. I thought that they were holding kangaroo cart outside of my room. They, I was, the room that I was in was at the back of a helicopter pad, so I thought they were bringing people in to come and be part of this cart, and the people that were dying, they were replacing with robots. And God was ending the world, and they wanted to torture me. I wouldn't eat, I wouldn't drink. I thought they were poisoning me with my own blood, so I was getting worse and worse.
It's quite similar, sorry to interrupt, Jack, as a coma, I believe. When you're put into a coma, you have these strange dreams.
It was very vivid. It was very vivid. But the stuff that they were giving me as well, tazoxin, which causes, it's used for super virulent infections, which I had several of. But unfortunately, it's like LSD, and it causes not only visions, but auditory, smell, taste. So, but it also caused me to have this really painful rash, and it was like burning. And I remember them quite vividly taking me into this room. I thought they'd give me a hit of sodium pentothal, because I just wanted to, I wanted to confess to everything that I'd ever done bad. I wanted to confess to every person about every person that I'd hurt. But because of the person that I was, and I, my hate for the police, I went mute. So I stopped speaking, stopped eating. I had, they put me into this bed, and as they did, there was a like the paper towels, and I thought it had acid on it because that's when the tazoxin hit. And as they moved me over to the bed, obviously, because they needed a barrier between me and them, so they put this towel, paper towel, over me. Because they really didn't know what I had at that point. It began to burn. So I thought they were burning me with acid. And that really broke me. I thought they were trying to torture me. And this went on for weeks. I don't know, I stayed alive, but I did. But I remember there was this one young doctor, this young female Asian doctor. And I've worked for the NHS in the past, and I know what, you know, you're allowed to wear a cross, but you're not allowed to have it showing. But she would come in, and this cross would hang out, and she'd look at me and she'd smile. And she'd see me looking at this cross, and then when somebody came in, she put it away. And this happened a few times.
It was like a sign.
It was. It was a sign for what was about to come. And it's when I met Jesus. At the end of my bed, I couldn't tell you what he said, what he looked like, but I just felt the love. And it's like these scales, this, I don't know, this filter that was over my eyes, this darkness just fell away, and I began to see and feel better instantly. The nurse came in and she looked at me and I said, can I have a bowl, please? I want to wash. I don't wash in weeks. Must have stunk.
Oh, it must have felt so good.
And I washed this rash away. It literally came away as I washed it away. It just literally peeled away. And I went, and I could barely walk, but I managed to get into the ensuite shower room, bathroom, and I had a shave. My hair was quite long. My beard was in my mouth. So I shaved the beard off and I shaved my head. Poor nurse had to come and sort it, but I think she was quite happy.
You were cleaning yourself up.
And then the doctor walked in, my specialist, and he looked at me and went, "What on earth has happened to you? How are you like this now? This morning you were still like that, and now you're like this almost instantly." I said, "I met Jesus." And he smiled. He smiled. Dr. Orrin Twentyman is his name. And the people from the church had been coming in, and I'd been giving them some, you know, when I was in that place, I was shouting at them and swearing at them and accusing them of being devils. The head of the the lead pastor of the church came, and at one point he couldn't pray for my soul because he was told they were going to lose me again, this time for good. And then a guy that I'd only ever spoken to once at the church came, and he brought me pink lemonade, LucasAid, crisps, sweets, tins of Spam. I love Spam. Absolutely love Spam.
And it is a British thing.
Yeah, and if you've never smelled anything as beautiful as Spam cooking on a hospital ward, because these nurses are so happy that you're eating, they're cooking it in their break room for you. I made nurses cry in joy. One of them I'm still really good friends with. She gave my kids guinea pigs. And I started getting better. I'd had a job previously, while I was in the hospital, obviously I'd lost it, but I'd been made redundant. And I had £200 redundancy money. Not a lot, no, but I hadn't been there long. But I decided, they said, if you can get to 8 stone, you can leave. And this is coming up towards mid-May. No, mid-April, sorry. Mid-April. And so I'd been in just under a month. And they said, if you get to 8 stone, you can leave. So I was having my breakfast on a morning when they were bringing it, going down into the canteen and having a fry up. Then coming back up for my snacking, snacking till dinner time, eating one of their dinners. An hour later, I'm going down to have another dinner. Tea time, doing the same. And at night time, supper time, every night, I'd got to know the guys at the local takeaway, and they'd be 2-for-1 pizzas for £10. No. 2-for-1 12-inch pizzas for £10. And I would eat one, and the nurses would share one. And I ran out of money on the last day. And I remember Nurse Jackie came in, and she went, "We love you. We absolutely love you, Jack. And it's been such a pleasure to see you recover. We want to buy you a pizza tonight." And they bought me a pizza. And I guess I was able to go home on the, I think it was something like the 28th of April. a few days before my stepson's birthday. And I'd start getting better and better. I was walking on two walking sticks. Started going to the church and started learning, started doing alpha. Don't know if you know what an alpha course is, but, you know, you learn about God and Jesus, and but in a good way, you know, in a way that it's not forced down your throat, in a non-religious way, finding out who they are. And I did that. And I must say, up to now, I now help lead our local alpha, and I'll be starting my 22nd alpha soon.
Awesome.
I started doing the evangelist courses at the church. We partnered with Bethel in California, Redding, California, and we started a school of supernatural life where God is so naturally supernatural and supernaturally natural. And we started, you know, building. So I was able to start the second year that they did that, and I'm now on something like my 15th, and I help teach, and, you know, we help teach about gifts and things like that. And I was told by people that my gift would be, I would change the face of entertainment, Christian entertainment. In 2016, I'd given up on my dream to want to become an actor. And then I get a phone call saying, can you come and meet this director? A friend of mine says, can you come and meet this director? You know, she wants to know about drug addiction. So I wondered if you'd go and talk to her about your life. She said, we'll send a taxi for you. So they did. I took my daughter with me. They looked after her while I went to meet this director, and this director was Joanna Hogg. And she was doing two films called The Souvenir and The Souvenir Part 2, back to back. And I sat and spoke with her, and she said, do you want to play Ray? I said, yeah, all right. And she said, can you advise on the film? The lead was Tom Burke, and the female lead was Honor Swinton Bryan, the daughter of Tilda Swinton. And I got to do a scene with her. And I worked with Tom on his portrayal of addiction. I worked with the whole production. It was funded by Martin Scorsese, partly. It's taken on by A24. When I did that, I'd written my first book and was in the process of getting it published. Then I was asked back a year or so later, to go and play Ray again. My part was just cut down substantially, but I got quite a few days on set working with some of the actors, talking about my life and stuff like that. You know, I got to pray with some of the Hollywood elite.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of saw it in a whole other light.
Yeah. And as actors are, they say, you know, they say, oh, we'll keep in touch and blah, blah, blah. It didn't happen, but, and then after the first Souvenir, I decided that I'd had a dream. Well, I'd had a dream, and I was decided that I needed to tackle some of these traumas in my life. And the biggest one was the abuse and the trafficking, being trafficked. So I felt God tell me that to write a book about trafficking, which I did.
Between
the street lights and red lights.
Oh, cool.
And it was published by a small independent publisher, War Cry Press, which is Pontefract, one of my original hometowns. I'd written some poems for a book about the wild man of Wakefield, Paul Sykes. He was a heavyweight boxer. He could have been the champion of the world had it not been for his addiction and prison. He wrote a really beautiful book called Sweet Agony. He died in poverty in 2007, homeless. I didn't know this, but I was contacted by a guy and asked to share my story about Paul. I'd done some debt collecting with Paul back in the day. Done a bit of work for the local gangland firms. And he liked my poetry and asked me if I could write some poetry. So I wrote some poetry. And then it went into his books, and I brought out my first book, A Personal Apocalypse, which is my memoirs, talking about pretty much everything that I've spoken about today, but with poetry that I'd written all the way through my life.
Oh, cool.
And then, you know, I was still sober. I'd built a relationship with my real mum. Back in 2007, I met her in 2007. My dad was about 3-4 months old when I met her. I wasn't the greatest son to her. I kept my family at a distance. My adoptive parents wouldn't speak to me. We do now. We're on speaking terms. I built bridges. I'm as stubborn as my mother is. But, my biological mother died suddenly of cancer in June 2017.
So like a year later?
No, April 2017, sorry. So it was the Easter. I was dealing with it. It wasn't easy. My sister was pregnant. She started to got a little girl. And in June, she had the baby Luna.
She'd had quite a
She had quite a difficult birth. So she went to bed and left the baby with her partner. She went to bed for a couple of hours and then she came back down. You know, this man had raised her other kid quite well, so she came down and the baby was unresponsive and quite limp. And she says, "What's happened?" And he said, "I fell asleep with her on my knee and she fell onto the floor." And it must have only been, you know, from this sofa to the floor, only a few feet. But it turns out her skull was broken. Her arm was broken. Her ribs were broken. She was brain damaged. And there was no way that that could have happened. So, like that. But when I got told that, my immediate thing was to go up to my church and get the prayer group praying and get a whole community praying. And they were. And then later on that afternoon, I get a phone call saying that Liam had admitted to the police that he'd lost his temper. He beat us so hard.
That's a tough thing to swallow.
And She was in hospital and her brain damaged on her thing. And five days later, they decided that they were going to switch off the life support. And she died peacefully. And he was in prison. We had questions that were wanted answering. He got life imprisonment with a minimum of 10 years. He was a 23-year-old guy, so he would have been out in his 30s. Less than a year into his sentence, he was murdered by his cellmate.
Oh.
Over a drug debt. Stabbed in the middle of the night and then left till morning until
the shift came in.
Opened up. He was murdered by a rapist.
Is that karma?
I don't know. I don't know what you would call it, but yeah, and then we had so many questions that went unanswered.
Wow.
We couldn't have a funeral for a year. And then when we found out the funeral, I was going to church. When I found out the funeral was, I couldn't go on my own. But one of the church leaders stepped up and went, "I'll take you." He even paid for the hotel the night before. And then after the funeral, I'm outside having a cigarette and his mother walked up to me and flung her arms around me and hugged me. And I broke and I cried and I cried and I sat in Chris's car and I cried. And I knew that I had to forgive him. I knew I had to forgive her. Not for him.
Yeah.
Not for her. But for me, for my own peace of mind. I knew that I had to do.
Losing you.
Love him.
Oh, there we go. You're back. You knew you had to love him.
Commanded. I did. I got my mind. That's the heal.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, you left again. Shake it, Jack. You froze on me. You froze. Oh no. I need to hear the end of the story, Jack. Oh no. Oh no. I think we'll have Jack come back here. What's happened? There. Oh, he's going to come back in. Oh God. You're killing me, Jack. Tears. Oh, there we are. He's back. There he is.
Sorry about that. I lost connection.
Yeah. Okay. We were. So
I decided I had to forgive him. And I forgave him and I started working on me.
Good.
I got married in 2019. And in when the first lockdown happened because of COVID, I decided that the first lockdown I didn't deal with very well mentally. The second lockdown, I decided that I needed to build my confidence, and I spoke to a friend of mine who's a hostage negotiator of all things. and decided that I would start talking about my life with other people, but I'd also be a voice to other people. So I started this podcast in my shed. I'd called it Shed X. I got in so much trouble with the TED Corporation. Then I started Live and Undrugged in January 2020. And then I started doing things like this because I knew that I find this so cathartic. I find this so healing.
Healing, yeah.
And if we've been through a certain way of life, if we've been through a certain thing, then we need to share that, and we need to educate.
Which is what I'm all about.
Hence you find me today sitting in my garden shed at 10:15 at night. Talking to us. And that's basically my story.
That's amazing. Amazing. Well, thank you. My goodness. And all the work you're doing at the church and helping others. And, you know, look at you go, Jack. Unbelievable. How many kids do you have now?
5.
Oh, gee, you didn't stop.
So she had eight all in all. Only one natural, only one biological. All the rest stepkids from an ex marriage, and my stepkids now. So she's got four kids, and I took them on as my own. You know, and we have 5 kids in a 2-bedroom bungalow at the weekend, which is quite hectic, but it's nice.
Yeah.
I've just re-released the first 2 books. So hoping to get a few sales. I'm sure that you'll put the link in somewhere.
I'll have your links down. Yep. We're on it.
That's me. Actor, writer, consultant, journalist, but you know, I've been known by so many things. But I'm sober, coming up to 8 years sober. And my life is so good. It's not always easy. I work a 12-step program. My life is with the church. I serve the church and I serve the community. Do I have a backup plan? I have one plan. Give it to God. He deals with the rest. You know, he's very good at micromanaging. I found that one out.
The hard way.
The hard way. And yeah.
Well, that's amazing. It's amazing, Jack. And you're amazing. And I have 3 questions for you. First, they're all easy. What 5 days were your worst days?
Well, 5 days were my worst days. The day that I thought I'd lost my daughter. The day that I lost my mum, my biological mum. The day that I lost my niece. And quite a few days in between when I was in hospital.
I was going to say, when you were in the hospital, that was torturous. I'm surprised that you didn't say the abuse time.
I kept that at bay for so many years. I repressed it for so many years. I'm dealing with it. Trauma, addiction, mental illness, these are all diseases of disconnection.
Yeah.
By tackling it, it's reconnection. By doing this, by connecting with other people, by speaking about it publicly, that's reconnection, and that's how I deal with it.
Yeah.
Can I change what happened? No. But can I take control of how I deal with that? Yes. So,
and it's made you the person you are today.
Yeah, and I repressed it. So that's not even in the factor. That happened.
Yeah.
What
5 days were your best? What 5 days were your best experiences?
My daughter been born. The day that I met and accepted Jesus into my life. The day that I met my wife. The day that I married my wife. There's been quite a few good days in between, but the day that I was baptized in my church, I was baptized with a guy by the name of Will, one of the young members of our church. He must have been in his early 20s. Now, Will's second name is Twentyman. And I walked in, and my wife, who wasn't my wife then, but she said, we looked over and we saw this man standing in the corner of the room with Will, and she went, wasn't that your specialist in hospital? And it was. And I was being baptized the same day as his son.
Oh, that's cool.
So that was an extremely cool and good day.
And what would you like to give your message to the listeners out there? What kind of message would you like to give?
That you may feel hopeless. You may feel helpless. You may feel like no one is listening. You may feel like there's no one to talk to. You may not feel good enough. These are all lies. It does get better.
Mm-hmm.
Don't suffer in silence. Reach out. Reach out to me. My link's in here somewhere.
Yeah.
Reach out to me. I'll gladly help you find the right
avenue.
Right avenue, yeah.
Well, that's very nice. Very nice. Thank you, Jack. And thank you for coming on the show. Thank you so very, very much. I'm blessed to have you come and tell your courageous and very suspenseful story. All along, each one was just like, oh, what's going to happen next? It definitely has to be a movie, Jack, definitely.
Well, we're working on it. We're working on it. The book's out, so
yeah
we're working
on
it.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you so very much. And it's definitely a lot longer than I usually go, but hey, guys, I had to hear the rest of the story. I couldn't leave it midway. Definitely not. So thank you again, Jack. Thank you so very much. So please take a moment, subscribe to our channel. I'm going to get my hand out again. Down here below, push on that bell. Push on that subscribe button so you know that we're here and we are going to send you guys more good, great people just like Jack here. So stay tuned for our podcast and our live streams. I have great conversations with some of the most interesting and accomplished people in the world today, just like Jack here from the UK. We grabbed him and he's done a super duper job today on our podcast. I think you'll be entertained, informed, and hope that we've inspired and motivated you to get your unique backup plan together, because nobody's Superman. So expect the unexpected. Thank you again to all our listeners out there. We know that you take your time out of your day to by choosing us, by listening to us. And if you're thinking about someone special in your life today that you love and care about, please reach out to them. Please call them, text them, go and visit them, because you don't know what tomorrow might bring. Tell them how much you love and care about them. And we always end our show with Carol Burnett. Jack, do you know who Carol Burnett is?
I can't say I do.
No? Well, she's a comedian. No. Had a comedy show on the North American Network for many, many years. And I always sing her songs. She's an inspiration to all of us with her humor and her fun shows. I'm so glad we had this time together just to have a laugh or sing a song. Seems we just get started. And before you know it, comes a time we have to say so long. So long, my friends. Stay safe. Be kind. Thank you, Jack, for coming on our podcast again today. Thank you so very much. Till next time, be kind. Stay safe.